Case number 21-3036, United States of America versus Tariq Abu Katwa, also known as Dean Adam, appellant. Mr. Zaff for the appellant, Ms. Tessier for the appellate.
Morning, counsel. Mr. Zaff, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. I have my COVID test. I'll remove my mask. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Bill Zaff. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Abu Katwa. With me is my client, John Jeffers. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Abu Katwa's appeal boils down to one overarching question. Is it fair and just to try a man for things he has not been charged properly with? Mr. Abu Katwa was charged with defrauding CareFirst, a large health insurance company. That's the charge the grand jury handed down. The false statements charges were allegedly made to CareFirst. The wire fraud and mail fraud charges were based on alleged fraud against CareFirst. And even the DC code identity theft charges were based on an intent to defraud CareFirst. But we had an indictment and a trial presentation from the government, opening statements, many witnesses, and a closing argument that was laser focused on putative fraud against small businesses and nonprofits, clients of Mr. Abu Katwa's business.
Here's the conundrum that I'm having understanding your argument. What you just laid out sounds like an argument that there was a variance between the indictment and the trial evidence. But that's not the argument that you've made in your brief.
No.
But that's what that's essentially what you're arguing. And the other problem is that the indictment charged CareFirst as the victim of the fraud. It just also mentioned that your client allegedly marked up the invoices that he sent to his clients and had them pay over and above what CareFirst was charging.
Right. Yes. I think there are two issues that are sort of bookends here. There's the convergence issue, which I think addresses just the indictment and whether convergence is a rule that should be applied and whether it was present or not. I recognize that there is a passage in the indictment that mentions that to obtain lower premium costs, but I think that the allegation that's in the indictment was based on money or property taken from the client. But
are you saying now, as you kind of intimated in your reply brief, that the government had to prove that your client obtained money that was supposed to go to CareFirst in order to prove up the fraud?
I think that the issue
that you didn't argue that below.
The defense below was materiality, really, the main defense, intent and materiality and willfulness. Okay. But materiality, it shows one good reason why the convergence rule should be applied. Because the bookend issue is 404. And how much evidence was allowed in and how much focus was on at the trial on the premiums that were charged to the client. The whether or not it was material to CareFirst was sort of hit on and moved on. We had 9 witnesses talking about the differences. The convergence makes sense here and makes sense to hold the government to a tighter rule because it really requires causality. That's the main issue here in terms of why we would have a rule like that. It ensures that a grand jury and the jury at trial focuses on whether false statements, deceit, that's to one party, cause that party to relinquish its property.
But you agreed below, but the defense agreed below that if CareFirst was deceived into charging less for its services than it would have charged if it had had accurate information, that was a legitimate theory of fraud and loss.
That would be a convergent That would be a convergent charge, yes.
And so why doesn't the indictment allege that?
I think that's not the gravamen of the indictment at the end of the day. And it's, I mean, the money.
Well, whether it's the gravamen or not, it charges that. It says that, doesn't it?
It says that. It's not clear to me from reading the indictment that that's what the grand jury was focused on in terms of who lost money. It talks about that he obtained $2 million.
Then you should have filed a motion to dismiss the indictment. And if that was denied, then we'd be appealing that, because then your argument is that the grand jury didn't really indict your client for the charge that he ended up being tried for.
Well, there was a motion to dismiss.
Well, you're not appealing that.
For lack of convergence.
Okay, so convergence is your theory that's before us. But again, that's different than saying that the grand jury was kind of like hoodwinked into indicting somebody for a crime that wasn't really presented to them. On your convergence theory, all we have to do is look at the letters within the four corners of the indictment and see whether it's there or not, assuming we agree that convergence is required.
No, understood. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that this, you know, the defense at trial, I think, tried to come at this multiple ways, because they knew early on, just from reading the indictment, what the government's strategy was going to be. Not to show that the large insurance fraud was ripped off, to show that these sympathetic clients were ripped off. And so that's where we get to Rule 4 or 4B, and whether that, all of that admission, whether that was proper, and whether that was so prejudicial that it outweighed any probative value.
I was going to go to 404B, so please.
Oh, I was going to say, you don't dispute, you haven't disputed that there was sufficient evidence for the jury to convict your client of defrauding CareFirst.
That is correct.
And you don't dispute that the jury instructions named CareFirst, said you must unanimously find that CareFirst was defrauded here.
That's correct, although...
So how would, even if there were I guess I'm trying to figure out how your argument works, because you said, we'll get to your 404 argument. But apart from that, if you don't dispute that there was sufficient evidence and you don't dispute the jury instructions, so they were properly instructed and they had the evidence to find what they were told to find, and we presume juries follow their jury instructions, then... I'm having trouble figuring out where your convergence argument gets you, because that sort of assumes that the record would only support a finding of, taking from one and defrauding one and taking from another. But you haven't raised either of those other two arguments.
Well,
you have a freestanding convergence argument, even if you don't dispute either what the jury was told, that the jury was properly instructed as to what they had to find to convict, and that they had sufficient evidence in this record to do it, but you can still win on a convergence claim?
Yes, I think the government came at that through arguing harmless error, is what the idea was that the jury instruction made any error for convergence harmless. And I think, the way to address that is that, it's presumptively prejudicial if you allow an indictment error like this. And that was in McKee and Milstein in the Third Circuit and the Second Circuit talked about that.
That's an indictment argument, not an argument about what happened at trial.
Correct. Okay. I mean, that's, but our argument for convergence is about that.
Right. Okay.
But then, moving on, I think our argument for trial is 404B.
Right. Just one other thing, this idea of convergence, is that something where does that come from? Is that settled common law? I mean, we had a couple quotes from the Supreme Court in your brief, which wasn't actually deciding the convergence question, but had the language that is consistent with your vision of this. But it wasn't clear to me whether, and courts haven't yet, we have not yet grappled with this.
Right.
What is the source of this convergence rule to begin with?
I think Lou in the Ninth Circuit, I do want to reserve a few seconds. Lou in the Ninth Circuit did address it and found in favor of it. I think it comes from the tradition of fraud, and I think the root of
Are you saying it's deeply rooted in the common law? that the Congress would have carried it forward.
I don't recall the case, but I think that there was discussion of sort of the bedrock principles of fraud.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest.
We will give you a little bit of time for rebuttal, regardless. And I just want to give you at least a little bit of a chance to address 404B since you've been trying to. But like, can I just start you off on 404B? As long as ready to shift.
Sure.
So 404B, my question is this, and maybe this will just give you a little bit of chance at least to say briefly what your argument is. 404B, typically, when I think about 404B, I'm thinking about evidence of other crimes. And what seems confusing about this one to me is a lot of your 404B argument is about this delta point vis-a-vis the insurance, the policyholders, his clients. But all of that evidence goes towards showing that he made a profit. And the fact that he made a profit, at least the fact that he made a profit, seems directly bound up in the crime itself. So why are we in 404B land at all? Because we're not talking about other crimes. We're talking about this crime and what was the conduct that went into committing this crime. It isn't the classic 404B situation where the idea is there's a crime that happened sometimes in the past. The fact that the person committed that crime in the past shows that he has a propensity to commit that crime again. That doesn't seem to be what's happening here.
Well, I think you could imagine two different frauds, right? You could imagine a fraud against CareFirst without defrauding the clients, or you could say, well, there was not an effect on CareFirst. They charged the same amount, and he actually defrauded and deceived clients. That would be a different crime. Here, I think what would be perhaps what you're getting at is what would be intrinsic, perhaps, is, although, again, as you read, this circuit has quite frowned on intrinsic evidence arguments. But the reason we're in 404B land, I think, is that that delta for the fraud against CareFirst was the difference between the premiums they charged and what they would have charged but for the alleged statements to CareFirst. And that was never buttoned up by the government. It was never related at all. There was never an argument, I don't think, that it was the same.
Then is the logical upshot of that argument then there could never be any evidence about the fact that he profited at all? Because that doesn't have to do with the delta between what CareFirst could have been charged and what CareFirst in fact was. But it does goes to show why he would have committed the fraud and how he benefited from it, how the crime worked, why he would have done it, which all just feels to me like it's bound up in proving the offense charged as opposed to taking some other crime and showing that that person therefore has the propensity to commit the crime that's been charged.
And I think our response to that was that the profit, the motive for deceiving CareFirst would be the difference between the premiums charged, and that the difference in the whole delta between the clients was that there was some other delta. Perhaps they were alleging that the clients were defrauded, which would not be the profit motive for the actual.
It makes no sense that the motive would be how much CareFirst would have charged had they known, like, what the, you know, real ages of all the real employees were. It matters not to the defendant. What the defendant put in his pocket was the delta between the invoice and the marked up invoice. I mean, your argument is that the jurors might be inflamed and you're prejudiced because they would be inflamed because these poor nonprofits and small business owners were cheated. And so that's our prejudice. That was your prejudice argument below. That's a lot of what you make in your brief. The flip side of that is that if the government can't put that on, then the jury is left thinking, like juror number six thought, hey, maybe this guy was a Robin Hood. And all he did was, you know, keep this big bad health insurance company from, you know, charging more to these small companies. And who cares about these big bad health insurance companies anyway? Health insurance is too expensive. Healthcare is too expensive. So the jury would believe that he did this for, you know, some altruistic reason, when indeed, evidence showed he didn't. He did it to line his pockets. Wouldn't that prejudice the government?
Well, in this case, so you, now you're in 404B if we're talking about profit, right?
Exactly. Okay. So even if I were to disagree with the chief judge that this isn't really other crimes evidence at all, even if it is, motive is a relevant reason to bring it in under 404B. The district court said common scheme. It's really kind of the flip side of what Chief Justice questions we're getting at. I mean, motive is always relevant. You know how many times I've seen somebody acquitted because the government didn't really have a good motive theory? I might have used that myself once or twice back in the day. You know how many times I've seen someone argue that motive of somebody else had to do the crime was Brady evidence? I might have used that once or twice myself back in the day. So why isn't motive relevant here?
Well, I think even if you say motive is relevant, we've got a prejudice issue. We've got 9 client witnesses that they lined up, and the testimony was cited where they lined up the 2 premiums. They, you know, elicited testimony about how it was marked up more than 100%, right, to these client witnesses. And then you have Agent Albee at the end lining up all of the differences, okay, to show the client, and then marked up the percentage difference to illustrate.
So now we're in 403 land.
Yes. I think ultimately, I mean, just the volume of evidence here. This trial was all about that.
So what's the best case you can cite where, for the proposition that we should reverse because excessive evidence of motive was introduced that was more ultimately more prejudicial than probative, and therefore the error was not harmless?
I think Wheeler would be the case for that. In that case, the government sought to invoke sympathy for the taxpayers. In this case, when it argued that 100% of the money for the fraudulently obtained Medicaid payments in that case came from hardworking taxpayers. I think it's very similar.
Can I go back to as a follow-on to Judge Wilkins' question? So, at the end of your response, you talked about the volume of evidence that was presented to the jury and in bolstering the notion that it was prejudicial, and the statistics and numbers that were presented in terms of the profit. But what was the profit that was being reflected? As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, because I might well be wrong, but as I understand it, it wasn't a comparison of how much the clients were defrauded, because it wasn't a comparison of if he hadn't committed a scheme, they would have only paid X, but by virtue of his scheme, they actually paid more, because in fact, some of them paid less than they would have on the open market. What the comparison was what was relevant to the crime itself, which is the difference between what he got from the clients and what he then paid to Care First. So that evidence is not evidence of defrauding the clients, as I understand it. That evidence just shows how much he benefited from the scheme to defraud Care First.
Mathematically, it's we don't know. It's not evidence of the difference between what Care First would have charged and what it did charge.
That's true. It's not that difference, but it's also not a difference that goes to the degree to which the clients were defrauded, which would be the other crime.
Well, I mean, when we don't have either known, I mean, and the way this was presented and the way it was argued at closing, jacking up the prices on the clients, doing this on the back of the clients, it clearly inferred that he was doing this to rip off.
But that wasn't the government's only argument about the fraud and the only evidence. The government presented evidence that it appears wasn't really contested by the defense, that age was really the driving factor of cost, and that by lowering the average age of employee, that was going to be like the predominant factor in affecting the cost of the premium. And thus, that was material. That was a material the seat that affected the price in a material way. I don't think that there's any argument in your brief that the government had to prove what the delta was, but that it was material, right? And so we don't know what those numbers would have been. Nobody tried to like reverse engineer and figure it all out, but it doesn't appear that that was required. If I don't know if you made the argument below that that was required,
but it goes to materiality, but they didn't bother. And that argument was.
But the point is that that you're not arguing here, as Judge Millett pointed out, a sufficiency claim, and you're not arguing here that like they didn't really prove materiality because they didn't prove what the delta was.
No, it's prejudice. It's prejudice. It focused the jury on not a sufficiency of the evidence. It's prejudice that this. The way this was presented just overwhelmed the trial and caused the jury. It shouldn't. You have to draw a line somewhere on 403, whether there's sufficient evidence or not. And we're asking you to draw the line. We're arguing that the government crossed the line.
And exactly what was the prejudice?
Prejudice was the 9 witnesses that they brought up over and over and over again to make a point that, you know, that they were inferring clearly. I mean, if you. The testimony infers that, you know, as much as 100%, in fact, that they marked you up, right? And there were, I believe there was at least a client or two that wondered, you know, if they were paying too much. And so, you know, that and then the argument in closing.
So is the prejudice that you believe that the jury convicted your client because they believed that that fraud was the fraud that was the subject of the healthcare fraud claim or one of the other claims? Or is it your theory of prejudice that they were so inflamed by that that they basically didn't hold the government to their burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt the healthcare?
I think it could be both. I think it's both. I think it overwhelmed it. It's certainly not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. The error, the abuse of discretion. That is our argument.
I mean, it seems like the and we'll let you sit down and hear from the government in a second. But it seems like the difference is the government is saying, look, he made money off Care First, and he committed a fraud against Care First, so he got money out of it. Now he could have committed a fraud against Care First and passed on the profits he got to you also. That still doesn't diminish the fact that the fraud was committed against Care First. It's just that the beneficiary of the fraud then turns out to be him instead of his clients. That's still not saying that the clients were defrauded. It's just saying that he didn't pass on the fruits of the fraud to them. That seems like the difference.
I think that that's an argument, certainly, that the government will make. And I think it's an argument that you can make in light of it. It's just that, I mean, the way that it was presented and the inference that was drawn here, it was prejudicial the way it was done through the client witnesses and the way it was presented with the side-by-side. Oh, in fact, you were charged more than 100% in what Care First charged. And in that case, I understand the mathematical difference and the profit motive, et cetera, but when you're talking about prejudice and you do it over and over again, when you have a Care First witness who says, no, I didn't bother calculate, and I could have, but I didn't, and then we're going to go through the client. So that's ultimately our.
Okay.
I should just one more question. For your 404 argument, who has the burden of proving that the evidence that's coming in is evidence of another crime?
Well, in this case, the government, was raised and was found by the court.
Just trying to, because some of these questions have been whether this evidence even was evidence of another crime, and I'm trying to figure out if someone's invoking 404, is it, someone needs to find up front that this other evidence is of another crime or bad acts.
And so that's whether it's intrinsic or not. I think that's an issue that parties skipped over in terms of the burden on that.
But usually, in a, I could be wrong about this, but I take it it's the defendant who raises an objection to the introduction of evidence on the basis that it shouldn't be admitted. And so, typically when the defendant raises the objection, then the burden is on the defendant to show that the rule would bar the introduction of the evidence.
And in this case, the court overruled the objection.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. Ms. Tessier.
May it please the court, Nula Tessier on behalf of the United States. In his brief on appeal, Mr. Abakatwa argues that the indictment should have been dismissed for lack of convergence. His argument in his reply brief and today is different. He's arguing that there was effectively a constructive amendment or a prejudicial variance. Of course, that argument is waived on appeal as it was raised for the first time in a reply brief and then only in a perfunctory fashion. But in any event, it's meritless. I think the court looks to three things when determining whether or not there is a constructive amendment to the indictment, the jury instructions, and the evidence. And all three here show that Mr. Abakatwa was charged and convicted under a convergence theory of fraud. The indictment alleged that he devised a scheme to defraud CareFirst and to obtain money and property from CareFirst by fraudulently obtaining health insurance premiums from CareFirst. The jury was instructed under this convergence theory. They were instructed that a scheme to defraud involves, quote, a materially false or fraudulent pretense intended to deceive others in order to obtain something of value, such as money, from the institution to be deceived. And of course, the evidence that Mr. Abakatwa, in fact, defrauded CareFirst was overwhelming. Perhaps the best evidence of that was his own handwritten notes explaining how his scheme worked. He obtained maximum return with a lower average age by modifying dates of birth to bring average age below 35, creating a balanced number of employees in every group, and adding dummies, young members.
Let's suppose we agree with all of that, but the district court recognized, you know, prior to trial and certainly after opening statements when juror number six made known to the court that they had some concerns because they were a small business owner who had CareFirst insurance, that there was this potential for prejudice. And so it warned the government about minimizing this evidence and not having it overwhelm the trial. And it seems, you know, according to the appellant here, that that was just kind of that was basically honored in the breach. Why shouldn't that be a concern?
Your Honor, the district court did identify that concern, and that's why the district court engaged in such a careful 403 balancing analysis of the evidence. And I think the defendant argues that all of this evidence relating to the clients was improperly came in as 404B evidence. The court, in fact, found that it was intrinsic to the charged offense, saying, I don't understand how the jury understands the scheme without hearing that evidence, but was conducted very careful 403 balancing analysis.
And where did that occur?
So that occurred pre-trial, and the district court, there were motions to exclude. So there's two parts of the client evidence. One was the amount of money that the clients paid to Mr. Abakatwa. The second part was whether or not the clients received the insurance benefits that they paid for. And the district court excluded any evidence that the clients did not receive the insurance benefits that they paid for. So what the jury heard was that these clients received much cheaper, that is a direct quote from the trial record, much cheaper premiums than they had obtained from other insurance brokers. So as far as the jury was concerned, the evidence was not that the clients were harmed in any way. The evidence was that the clients received cheap insurance premiums, and the jury never heard the follow-on fact of that the clients did not receive the full benefits that they believed they were getting from CareFirst. That's exactly the kind of 403 balancing that is left to the discretion of district courts. This court in Douglas said that you disturb a 403 determination by a district court only where there is a grave abuse of discretion. And I think the district court's very careful analysis here is far from a grave abuse of discretion. I think the district court did a very good job in ensuring that there was sufficient evidence that the jury could understand the fraud without being worried that the clients were harmed in any way.
They could understand the fraud and the motive if you simply showed this differential for 2013, for example. But you had charts that were from the difference between what was premiums paid by the client and what the premium sent from Care First was from 2010 to 2013. And we're sort of beating this point to death during the trial in very, very large volume. And so the district court's balancing up front is one thing, but policing the evidentiary presentation during the trial is another thing altogether. And their concern is with what the train went off the tracks during trial. What on earth reason was there for putting in these large, long exhibits and testimony about this delta in charges between the difference that he was pocketing for 2010, 2011, 2012, all that time? Why did you need that volume of evidence?
Well, Your Honor, there's two separate questions embedded in that. One is whether the evidence of the premiums paid by the clients was relevant. And the second question is what...
I said the difference is relevant to show motive. You could have done that with evidence from 2013. The jury would have gotten the point. But instead, the government proved put in evidence for 2010, 2011, 2012, and kept hitting the point over and over and over and over. Why did you have to engage in such overkill? What was the point of 2010, 2011 on just this issue?
Well, this was the scope of the scheme charged in the mail fraud and wire fraud counts. The scheme began in 2010. And so all of that was still intrinsic to the charge defense. It was part of the same scheme. The district court did several things to limit any potential prejudice. And really on the time frame, the defendant's argument really only related to count one. That was the only count that arguably had a statute of limitations issue. The district court made the point, look, even if this evidence doesn't come in on count one, it comes in on the remaining counts, because that was the time period in which the defendant executed his scheme to defraud Care First. And the government is entitled to put in evidence of the entire scheme that the defendant engaged in. The government is not limited to the minimum amount of evidence necessary to prove the elements of the offense, but can, in fact, prove the entire crime. Now, I agree that a district court might limit evidence in certain ways if it's worried about undue prejudice. And I think the district court took several steps here to limit any concerns about undue prejudice, one of which was segregating the evidence by time period. Another was, and this was fairly significant, excluding any evidence that the clients were harmed in any way by this fraud. I don't think the fact that Mr. Abukatwa made a lot of money on his fraud, I don't think that's unfair prejudice. I think that is the natural result of the crime that he committed. And I would go back to, it may be that a different judge would make a different assessment of what is the right balance on 403. That is exactly the kind of decision that is put squarely within the hands of trial judges. And that's why this court has said that 403 assessments, and that's really what defendant's argument is, it's a 403 argument.
But during, after the opening statement in the brouhaha over juror number six, district court said, you know, government, you can't argue that the clients were deceived and lied to. I think that those were kind of paraphrasing almost the district court's exact words. And then in closing, the argument, the government argued that the clients were deceived and lied to.
Isn't it true
that that's essentially what happened?
So the government did argue that the clients were lied to in closing. I think briefly, I don't think it was the main force of the government's closing argument. I would note the defendant hasn't raised a challenge to the closing argument as problematic in this case, and so that argument would be waived on appeal. I also, and I apologize because I don't remember exactly the court's language, but I'm not sure the court said that the government could not introduce any evidence that the clients were deceived, but rather that could not argue that the clients were defrauded. And there's a difference between the two, because, of course, the clients were deceived as part of this fraud because the government had to show that the clients did not agree to have their birth dates changed. They weren't the ones giving Mr. Abu Khatwa the false birth dates, but he was the one changing the birth dates without their permission, which is, of course, a deceit on his clients. But that's not a fraud on his clients because, or at least the government did not argue and prove that that was a fraud on the clients. I can imagine a universe in which that could be part of the case showing fraud.
The district court said at JA 190 to 191, I am not going to let you stand up in front of the jury and say, look how he lied to these clients. Look how he deceived. That's an exact quote.
And I apologize, Your Honor, for misremembering the exact record. Again, Mr. Abu Khatwa has not argued that, he has not argued that there was any misconduct during the closing argument. And I do think that one statement is also part of the greater ruling by the court that in order to explain to the jury how this fraud worked, it was necessary to show that Mr. Abu Khatwa, in fact, made money off the fraud. And I think juror number six question exactly explains why that was necessary for the government to prove. Juror number six argued, what he said was, I'm listening to the opening statements and I'm wondering if my broker had done this, would I have paid a lower rate? And so immediately the question that the jury asks is Mr. Abu Khatwa lying to Care First in order to pass on the savings to his clients? And so the government was entitled to show that, in fact, no, he had a motive to do this, which was to profit himself by charging the clients more than he paid to Care First. And also, the jury could reasonably infer from the fact that the multiple witnesses testified that the premiums that they paid to Mr. Abu Khatwa were much cheaper than those available on the open market for similar insurance coverage. And so the jury could infer from the fact that the amount paid to Care First was even lower than that, that Care First would have charged more if it had had accurate information, because that's what the going rate on the market was so much higher.
So that goes to materiality.
But that certainly goes to materiality and also, of course, to motive, which is always relevant.
So we didn't cover this in appellant's time. I have a question about the summary witnesses, if we can transition to that. So why is it appropriate for a summary witness to testify about conclusions that they have reached from going through the documents that have been introduced at trial, which is what Agent Henson did in testifying that, well, all of these people were dummy employees. And I can tell that based on looking at all of these facts. Why isn't that something that the prosecutor could argue in closing, but that a summary witness shouldn't be testifying to at trial?
But certainly, Your Honor. Well, this court said in Lemire and found no error in Lemire that summary witnesses should avoid controversial inferences, but didn't say that summary witnesses can make no inferences at all. And in fact, you know, inferences are often a part and parcel of the kinds of calculations.
How do we know what a controversial inference is?
Oftentimes an inference is controversial. You can identify that from the fact that the witness was cross-examined as to that inference and the basis for that inference. Mitchell is a great...
Isn't a critical fact, like whether these were fraudulent names, they were dummies. Surely that counts as controversial. It's a controversy before the jury.
So, Mr.
It can't be that just because they do a cross-exam, they can infer anything they want as long as they don't get cross-examined. That can't be the test.
No, certainly it's not the test that they can infer anything they want so long as they're not cross-examined.
Right, so inferring that these were dummies was not summarizing evidence, that was testifying. And we agree that that was not summarizing evidence, it was making a factual inference on a disputed question?
Well, I think there is, she labeled them as dummies, but she explained why she made the list that she did. And she said, I made this list based on the fact that they had the middle initial D. That is a summary of the exhibit.
Right, and she could stop there. And then the prosecution could make, as Judge Wilkins said, the prosecution can make the argument. But the jury's told arguments aren't evidence. But instead, she gets up as a witness and stops summarizing and starts inferring and telling the jury that they all had the middle initial D because that was a signal that they were the dummies in this case. I don't mean they were individually dummies, but they were fakes. They were fakes in this case. And that's just not summarizing evidence that I can, or help me understand on what possible theory that is summarizing in a non-controversial, objective way, evidence.
Well, there was already evidence, documentary evidence in the record regarding the use of the term dummy.
I understand that. That would be a harmless error argument. I'm just asking you, can you explain to me, or is your argument just a harmless error one, that was an oops, but it didn't make a difference at the end of the day?
So I think it's a few different parts. I do think that goes to whether it is an inference, because she is looking at the documents and saying, I looked at the documents and...
She wasn't summarizing evidence about, in the record, about references to dummies. That wasn't what she was summarizing. So it's not that she was pulling that evidence together, and there would be no... I can't imagine the showing that would be needed for the jury, that it was so voluminous. References to dummy during the trial were so voluminous, she had to pull them together. She could have said, I pulled these folks together because they all have the middle initial D, and there's something, you know, they all have some problem somewhere with their identifying information, and stops there.
Certainly. And to be sure, the defendant, if the defendant had specifically objected to that testimony, the district court may have excluded that specific testimony, because the district court did repeatedly say, I don't want the witnesses here to make any conclusions or inferences.
Well, the district court, the defense objected to these witnesses before they took the stand. The government made a proffer of what they were going to testify to.
That's correct, Your
Honor. My understanding is that proffer did not include, oh yeah, and she's going to testify that these people were dummies.
Based on her inference.
I believe that the defense counsel was able to look at the charts and summaries before the defendant, before the witness testified.
That's not the problem. The problem is what she said, that she, what her inference was.
Certainly.
She took that to mean.
And the judge allows the summary witness to testify doesn't, I think, excuse the defendant from objecting to testimony that it believes exceeds the scope of what the district court has allowed. But even if
my question to you was, do you believe that her statement about inferring that the middle initial D signaled that these were all dummies as in fakes, was that proper summarization?
I think that this court has not precluded.
I'm asking you whether that, yes or no, was that proper summarization?
I think that was an inference that this court has said that summary witnesses can make some inferences.
Could they make that type of this? I'm not talking about our general law, really. I'm really asking a specific question. And that is, does the government think that what she said in this case about the inference that she drew from those middle initials, that specific statement was proper summarization? Is that the position of the government or not? You can have a harmless error argument. You can have anything else you want. They didn't object. I'm just asking how you understand summarization.
I'm afraid that you won't like my answer. Mm-hmm. I think that
Is that like or not? I just want to know.
I think that it is the closest call to whether that is okay. That is the piece of evidence in the record that is closest to a controversial inference. I am leaning from this court. What this court has said is controversial inferences are disfavored. I think that is the closest thing to a controversial inference.
When has the court said that non-controversial inferences are okay?
This court has not expressly stated that controversial, non-controversial inferences are okay. But okay, I'm not aware
so,
of any...
So I guess just to kind of follow up on Judge Millett's point, putting aside whether the error is harmless or not, we have to, you know, if we're writing an opinion and we have to say what is going to be the rule in this about what summary witnesses can do and can't do, give me your best argument about why it's okay for a summary witness to give any inferences about what the evidence means or shows.
I think some amount of inference is often inherent in the summary itself. It is often very difficult to summarize the evidence without having any inferences at all.
So I take it, from the way I think about this, is that an inference sometimes is just an absolute natural byproduct of something that someone has already said. So a summary witness has to be summarizing something else. They can't be testifying to new things on their own, or otherwise it's not summarizing. And sometimes you can just say, well, that person didn't exactly say that, but that's the only thing that you could infer them to have been saying. That's is what they were saying. But I don't think there's any other witness who testified, not that there weren't dummies, I think it's okay to call them dummies because they're all fake people, right? The people we're talking about.
So it's, they're not fake people. They were often real people whose names were altered.
Right. So but as altered, they're not a
yes,
real person.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay. So I just, yes, just in case to close in one loop. So instead of just saying fake, instead of dummy, I guess just make us a little more comfortable with the vernacular here. But nobody, I think, testified other than the summary witness that the initial D was the demarker of somebody who was a fake person. That only comes from the summary witness.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then it's hard to see how that's an inference then, because that's not a natural byproduct of something that somebody else said. That's a new fact that's injected into the case by the summary witness, who's not summarizing what somebody else said. Summarizing sometimes would require some degree of inference, but it wouldn't require the introduction of some new fact.
So yes, that's correct. But there were multiple witnesses who testified that their name did not have the middle initial D. Mm-hmm. And so that was the middle initial that was repeatedly used. And so I think the inference that she made,
but none of those witnesses, first of all, the people whose names were altered by the introduction of the middle initial D would have no reason to know what the D stood for.
That's
and
correct.
Then the witness who testified would have to make what seems to me a new factual point about it, which is that not only was there the initial D, not their actual middle initial, but the initial D was an indicator that the person is a dummy person, meaning a fake person. That seems like a new thing.
So the inference that the initial D referred to a dummy. I apologize if I'm wrong about this, but my memory of the trial transcript is not that she said that the initial D references a dummy. She says, this is the list of dummies. Why is that the list that you came up with? Because it was all people who had the middle initial D.
Right.
Because this was all people who didn't appear elsewhere on the roster as working for a benefits consulting client at that time. But it is an inference, and I think we can maybe parse hairs on how much of an inference is acceptable. I think, for example, one of the things that the district court said was, you can testify, this was related to Jill Albee, you can testify that money came into this account and that money went out of that account. But I don't want you to come to the conclusion that the defendant was paid money by CareFirst. Now, of course, that's the natural inference that one would draw from money being paid into an account from CareFirst into a benefits consulting account is that is the money that came from CareFirst. That's the kind of non-controversial inference that courts allow in all the time when we're talking about Rule 1006 summary charts. Those are normal and natural inferences. They're not controversial inferences. That's why I think this court has said that when you have a summary witness, and this was in Lemire, which wasn't a 1,006 witness. It was a witness who was summarizing testimony, which is different. And the witness here didn't summarize testimony. She summarized documents. But that's why the court said that you should avoid finding having controversial inference. But I'll note in Lemire, there were controversial inferences made by the witness, and this court still found no error. And so while this court has not expressly said that inferences are okay in those words, the fact that this court has found no error where even controversial inferences were made, I'd point the court to Mitchell. Mitchell is a case where on cross-examination—
When you say no error, you mean harmless error. Whatever happened was harmless. Or that
No, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I agree that it is harmless error. But the court in Mitchell found no error at all.
Mm-hmm.
The court in Lemire found no error at all. They didn't just find that any error was harmless. They found no error.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why—
Was that under plain error or harmless error?
I believe under both Lemire and Mitchell, it was a harmlessness review. I think it was in Weaver that it was plain error. But I think that, and maybe now I am making an inference, but I am inferring from the court's lack of a finding of error in Lemire and Mitchell that there was similarly no error here. But,
and you're not making a plain error argument here on this issue, right, as I recall?
So I'm not making a plain error as to the introduction of the evidence as a whole because the defendant, in fact, objected.
Right.
The defendant in his opening brief did not, threw a bunch of evidence at the wall, but didn't really make specific arguments from any particular pieces of evidence. We addressed the dummies piece in our response brief, recognizing that that is perhaps the closest to a controversial inference. I don't recall from the record that the defendant specifically objected to that piece of testimony. Certainly the defendant didn't take the opportunity to cross-examine. And that's what the court said in Lemire and Mitchell repeatedly, that the way that you limit the risk of undue prejudice when you have a summary witness who is making some inferences is you allow full cross-examination by defense counsel. And the defendant here chose not to cross-examine the witness. So if the defendant wanted to reduce any potential prejudice from that particular piece of evidence, he could have done so by cross-examining, but chose not to.
Right, but none of that gets to whether this was proper summarization. What she said was, the court says to her, when you say dummy, what do you mean by dummies? And she says, a person who doesn't work for the company, she defines it. And then right before that, she says, I think this is a counsel asking, tell us what some of these exhibits show with respect to these dummies. From looking at the history of changes, the dummies almost always have the middle initial D.
That's correct. And I agree with you that this would be certainly an easier case if she had not used the word dummy. If the summary witness had simply said, I put together a chart of individuals that were not listed as benefits consulting clients anywhere in the record, but nonetheless were billed to Care First. And she said a lot of those individuals have the middle initial D. If that had simply been her testimony, I think there's no question that that would be proper. The addition of the word dummy to characterize it, I agree with the court. That is the most controversial inference that she possibly made. But again,
it's not just that she called them that. Is that she said she discerned what was in her view a pattern, right? From looking at the history of changes, the dummies almost always have the middle initial D. That's a factual statement that she has made and no one else has made. Other witnesses didn't know that other people had Ds as middle initials.
So I think if she had said, I put together a list of the individuals who were being billed to Care First, but didn't show up as a benefits consulting employee and said, and I observe that in my summary exhibit that lists all these individuals, most of them have the middle initial D.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone would view that as a controversial inference. She's just stating what is in.
What did she testify about why she put this list together?
I I don't recall if she was asked why she particularly put this list together. I think the judge was careful about not having the summary witnesses explain sort of the investigation. But I'm not sure she has to explain why.
Well, here's what I'm getting at. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that I am concerned about summary witnesses essentially being kind of prelude for junior varsity prosecutors, making the prelude to the closing argument. So the government puts on their whole case, and then they call a summary witness to wrap it up, to basically summarize the evidence by telling the jurors what they should infer from all of the evidence. Suppose I think that that's not the way to run the railroad, and that we should have a rule that just says that doesn't happen. That's error. What would be wrong with us doing that in this case? Why shouldn't we do that from the government's perspective?
I certainly don't think this is the case to do that, because it has no, I don't think it has any impact on the outcome of this case. Because the evidence was so overwhelming, I don't think that any error affected the defendants, prejudiced the defendant in any way, as to the verdict. I think this court is careful not to tell district courts how they should be running their trials in every case. I think this court's deferential review of evidentiary determinations, particularly deferential as to 403, is a reflection that the rulings need to meet the case, and that it is the district court who has the case in front of it who is best able to determine what the best presentation of evidence is in terms of ensuring the government can admit probative evidence, and that for any particular piece of evidence, the potential for unfair prejudice does not substantially outweigh the prejudicial value. Do you think the rules already provide that courts can exclude evidence under Rule 403? This court has already told district courts to ensure that there is full cross-examination, to allow defense counsel to review summary exhibits before they are presented to the jury, and to limit controversial inferences. I think the district court made an effort to do that here. Whether the district court did that perfectly or not.
Well, here's the other rub on that, is that if a prosecutor argues what the inferences are in closing, the jurors might be convinced by it, they may not be, but they're also told that the prosecutor's closing, just like the defense closing, isn't evidence. The jurors can, take it or leave it. We've said that summary charts aren't evidence. The evidence are the documents that the charts are based on, but the charts themselves aren't evidence. Or we've said that in some cases.
I don't.
But here, the opposite was said. But here's my point, is if we have a rule that says that a summary witness's testimony is evidence the same as anybody else's testimony, and if the summary witness can testify to their inferences and conclusions, then we're basically saying that a witness for the prosecution can make an argument or an inference about the evidence from the witness stand under oath, and that is evidence, whereas if the prosecutor made that same inference and argument in their closing argument, that wouldn't be evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Why isn't that a problem?
It's not a problem for several reasons. So first of all, the reason why, this is why cross-examination is so important. Prosecutors aren't subject to cross-examination. Summary witnesses are, and the defense counsel can cross-examine on that inference. Many witnesses make inferences in their testimony. In fact, there's inferences are a natural part of testimony, and that is treated as evidence before the jury.
If they're experts.
No, that, no, Your Honor.
Or fact witnesses, yeah, they can make, you know, they can make an inference that it snowed last night if, like, they went to bed and there was no snow on the ground and they woke up and there's snow on the ground. They could make an inference from that, but that's different than saying, oh, you know, I looked at all of these five different pieces of evidence and I can infer that this occurred from all of those various facts.
Well, I don't believe that is different, Your Honor. Every witness is allowed to make inference. A Rule 1006 witness is making inferences from particular documents that are themselves admissible. There are any number of witnesses that can make inferences from evidence that they review, such as the fact that it's raining outside. That's a piece of evidence. Or the fact that a bunch of people have umbrellas is a piece of evidence from which someone infers that it is raining outside. Those are the kind of inferences that Rule 1006 witnesses make. But I would also note, Your Honor, this court said in Weaver that a Rule 1006 chart is itself evidence. Rule 1006 is not a rule that allows you to have demonstratives. Demonstratives are something that the government might have in its closing argument. That's not evidence. But a Rule 1006 chart is itself evidence. And that's what this court said in Weaver. It said it was not plain error to fail.
We're talking about the summary witness testimony here, not the chart. We're talking about the testimony here.
So this court has said in multiple cases that the proper way to get a Rule 1006 chart into evidence is through the witness who prepared it.
Okay. We're just going in circles here. None of us are, we're not here arguing about that. And we're not raising questions about that, right? We're really raising questions, at least I am, about what the proper scope of testimony is and saying it's all, the government can do anything it wants as long as the government, or as long as the defense can do cross-examination, seems to me an insufficient answer. They can have their witnesses say anything and make any inferences they want because the protection is district courts and cross-examination. I was asking my question at least because I was hoping that the government had a sense of where the line was. But it sounded from your answer like the government doesn't have a sense where the line is here.
No,
or if not, please tell me what she could have said that would have crossed that line.
No, Your Honor, and I apologize because I did not mean to imply that there's no line at all.
Okay, so what more would she have had to say to cross the line into an impermissible inference in the government's view?
Oh, certainly if she said that I infer from this that the defendant defrauded Care First, or I inferred from this that the defendant lied to Care First, certainly that would have crossed the line. That's the kind of conclusion that a summary witness can never make. And so certainly, but we agree that they're absolutely, that is a very...
I infer from this that the defendant was engaged in falsehoods. That was the line.
I think if it, I
would
think,
that cross the line?
Yes, that if
okay,
she
that's
said,
what saying, I infer from this, these people were dummies, and cross the line. That's falsehoods. And yeah, I'm done with this line.
Can I just summarize, so to speak? Mm-hmm. Because I think, in my mind at least, the issue here is not whether the summary witnesses can testify to things in the same way that other people testify to in terms of creating evidence. It seems like they can. The question is whether they're summarizing. That seems to me to be the issue. And so suppose you had two people, each of whom testifies and says, yeah, I'm a person who is a beneficiary of a policy, but when I gave my name, I gave my actual middle initial, and now I see from the records that actually my middle initial has been transposed to D. That's person A. And then person B comes along and says the same thing. Yeah, I gave my name, but turns out my middle initial was transferred to D. That's not my middle initial. And then the summary witness comes up and says, I'm summarizing the evidence given by the two people. I've made a chart. Here's the two lines. And then gets asked, well, why do you think they use the middle initial D? I think it's probably because they meant to signify that they're dummies. That seems to me to be not summarizing the testimony that's already been given, but that's injecting a new fact that says the D stands for dummy. That's the rub here. And harmless error is a place, obviously, you can go, and you've said that a couple of times. But in terms of whether that's summarizing, it's hard to see how it's summarizing when neither of the witnesses in the hypothetical who testified knew anything about why the middle initial D was used. And then the summary witness says, I think the middle initial D was used because that signifies dummy.
And I understand the court's concern. I do want to clarify one thing, because I think it was a little confusing in the defense brief, and it may be irrelevant, but the witnesses here were not summarizing previous testimony because they, in fact, weren't allowed in. They were summarizing records.
They
were purely explaining what they did with the records and how they put the records together.
Yeah.
I agree with Your Honor that with the court, that the most difficult aspect here of the case is the use of the word dummy. I do think it is easy to resolve that on a harmlessness grounds because the evidence was so overwhelming. I think the reason why I'm reluctant to agree that the district court erred here is because of the deferential standard of review, and because this court has in the past found no error where, for example, a witness testified based on, admitted that the testimony was based in part on an external investigation unrelated to the evidence produced at trial. And the court found no error in that instance. That was in the Mitchell case. And so I'm reluctant to concede error in light of this court's precedent in Mitchell, but I do understand that that is the piece of evidence that the court is most concerned about. And the easiest way to dispose of that particular problem is by finding that any error, if there was any, was harmless.
Okay. Let me ask my colleagues if they have additional questions.
I just have one more thing. And if you have the government supplemental appendix, it's page 438 and 439.
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not have the entire
memo. Okay. All right. So, and up front, this is not something they've raised. It's just something that actually for me was profoundly troubling in this case. And so I just want to communicate it to you, not your personal capacity, but to the United States government, because I found this deeply disturbing. And this goes to the execution of the search warrant at his house. And what the FBI agent testified was, and this is the bottom of 438 to 439, is, you know, we're going to have to do a forced entry because no one was answering the door.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
They were going to do a forced entry because nobody was answering the knock at the door. So it's 438 and 439. The decision, quote, the decision was made, since it was an affluent neighborhood, we knew we had to make a forcible entry at that point. But due to the aesthetics of the neighborhood, we decided to use a rear entrance so as to maintain the integrity of the front of the residence. Are you aware that the FBI has a policy of deciding not to break down the front doors in rich neighborhoods?
No, Your Honor, I was not aware.
Okay.
And I apologize. There was not a suppression ruling issue.
No, no, I said up front, they haven't raised it. I don't mean to blindside you, but this is such outrageous behavior by the FBI. I mean, if there really is a policy out there that in non-affluent neighborhoods will break down the front door, but for the rich people will go in quietly in the back door, that's deeply troubling. It's shocking to me that it didn't get more attention. So that's why I call it to your attention. That's all. I don't expect you to respond.
I appreciate Your Honor, and I will pass that on to my management.
Thank you.
Thank you for raising that, Judge Millett. I was a public defender here for 10 years. I can't tell you how many times my clients had their front doors bashed in. I don't remember a single time where any agent or police officer was worried about the aesthetics of what their house would look like after they executed a search or arrest.
I understand the court's
concern. And I'm not holding you responsible for it. You personally, obviously.
But I understand troubling. Why it's upsetting to the court.
Thank you, Ms. Tessier. Mr. Zapp, we'll give you 2 minutes. We'll give you 2 minutes for your rebuttal.
Ask is quite tight. I'll try to be quick on just a couple points, not all the points, obviously, that came up. On summary witnesses, there was a lot of talk about deference to the lower court. And I just want to point out in Lemire, the court said that there are obvious dangers posed by the summarization of evidence. Although we usually defer, this is a quote, although we usually defer to the district court's assessment of whether the probative value of evidence outweighs the possibility of prejudice, the the pervasiveness of these dangers requires that we review the use of summary witnesses post. So it is a different standard of review set forth in Lemire. Another part of summary witnesses, another part of the government's argument was that cross-examination could have cured all of it. And that is one issue that Lemire raised. But in this case, like with the dummies, it was a fact that was established. You can't cross-examine someone for making an improper inference. That's a rule.
You could have objected. I mean, the counsel, I don't mean you personally, but counsel could have objected when Agent Hinson made that statement.
Yes, Your Honor. There were a lot of objections to the summary witnesses, including during, and a lot was based on personal knowledge, which I think dummies also falls into. And counsel was not making any headway there. And so I think, you know, he made, this was discussed, and I think those sites are in there, probably more than any other issue, numerous times throughout the trial leading up to the summary witness testimony, kept coming back during different, every time the jury left, and counsel was very persistent, I think, just in terms of the general nature. And I think it's the same kind of, if it wasn't an objection right at the dummies, it was done during testimony, as far as at least personal knowledge I know. And that was a lot of what Hinson was doing, was going through CareFirst documents, not a CareFirst employee, and saying, this is what this means, this is what that means, this is what this means. And so cross-examination, I don't think, is a sufficient way to cure that. The way, what Lemire said, when you have a summary witness, it said that you need a caution, you need a guarding instruction. And in this case, there was not only not a guarding instruction, there was the opposite instruction, which is rather than say that the summary witness testimony and exhibits are not themselves evidence, and so, you know, don't consider them as evidence. Instead, the court actually instructed, this is evidence like any other evidence. Just consider it.
The district court asked counsel to opine on that proposed instruction, and counsel said, fine, whatever.
Yeah, I think counsel was more concerned with the expert issue at that point. I think he said,
but you can't okay. Come up here and say that there's a problem with the limiting instruction when and not mention the fact that the district court said, well, this is the instruction I intend to give, and defense counsel didn't object, didn't propose something different, didn't note any sort of a problem at all, and said, yeah, fine.
We agree that it's a plain error now. I don't believe it's a waiver. I don't believe it was a conscientious decision to waive that.
I mean, it can be, you don't have to reach that level for it to be considered an invited error.
To be considered uninvited?
An invited error.
Well, I think that in reading the colloquy, I don't think that this could be read as sandbagging for an appeal issue. I think it was simply an oversight, if anything. Because of the concentration on the expert. So, but even under a plain error, I think it's more appropriate to fall in the plain error world on that. And undoubtedly, there's a higher standard of review there, we're fighting a little bit uphill on that. But when you have, and the district court recognized that these were summary witnesses. She said that this particularly are dangerous. It's pretty clear that she was aware of the issues of summary witnesses, and you know, it's not something that was just out of the blue that the district court wouldn't have been aware that a guarding instruction might be appropriate here, but then actually gave the opposite. And so that's why we argue that it's plain error.
Okay, let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you.
Ms. Tessier, I want to make crystal clear, I wasn't blaming you or holding you responsible at all. I'm sorry if it upset you. It just felt very important for me to communicate that point. So I apologize. Yes, okay, but It's not, I'm not holding you responsible for it. Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments this morning. We'll take this case under submission.